Committee Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety to order. Today is Wednesday, March 14th. We are having a public hearing on 5544, so I will gavel in. First I will ask Sheila to give a report on some of the documents we have in front of us.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to point out the agency has provided you with some additional information on a breakout of disproportionate minority contact. The question was asked yesterday about Measure 11 and DOC offenders compared to other offenders in the system. So that you can put by page 17 of your presentation materials. And then in addition to the people that have signed up for public testimony today, there is a letter in front of you from the Central and Eastern Oregon Juvenile Justice Consortium. So I just wanted to call your attention to that as well.
Very good. Any questions of staff on that report? I will then gavel in a public hearing on Senate Bill 5544. Welcome everyone here. Thank you all so very much for coming. And we will just jump right in and have in order the first witness we have on our list, Judge Thomas Hart. And we have somewhat of a crowded agenda, so if we can limit our testimonies, I get very cranky if someone's going to be going over 5 minutes, I think. And as we get down, it will get shorter. So please try to honor and respect the other people that will be following you by having concise testimony. Judge, enter and sign in, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Hart, other members of the committee, Senator Brown, Senator Winters, it's nice to see you. Thank you, Representative Cameron, my hometown crowd. Not you, Senator Brown, but I do know your sister. I am a circuit court judge from Marion County and a member of the Juvenile Corrections Population Forecasting Committee and have been for at least the last 6 years. It's my pleasure, and I am very proud to appear before you today. First off, this is the OYA budget, and I'm going to let the other people that know the budget talk a little bit more about what they're going to be doing. I want to talk to you about my perspective on the ground, what I'd like to see. The governor's proposed 145 closed custody beds and 75 community placement beds are a good place to start, and I don't think anybody should go below those. They are below what our projection is, and our projection, which is now 87 beds for closed custody beds over the biennium, includes dependency risk factors that they didn't include in the past. It's always been my intent as a member of the committee to accurately reflect the nature of the youth offenders that we have in the system. And I believe we have a better understanding when we factor in those kids that end up in the corrections system at the youth level that matriculate to the adult correction system, which I see as a problem. Because they do matriculate, and a lot of people don't pay the attention they need to because they just let them age out of the juvenile system. I'm here to talk to you about today is my interest in accurately reflecting the offender population and being able to provide appropriate sanctions and services. There's a continuum of kids, some of them from diversion locally at the juvenile departments through closed custody, serious offenses, Measure 11, then they're aging out. What we need to do is get to some of the kids. Let me make it just really clear. At times, I have, for lack of a better option, sent a kid to a closed custody discretionary bed in the OYA because it was not appropriate for me to leave that child at home. I did not have a resource locally, and I needed to be able to try to get to that offender while the getting was good. And from my standpoint, I'd like some of these beds that I filled, and I know that that's going on around the state. I'm not the only one that has done that. I'd like to save those beds for the most serious offenders because we need that from a public safety standpoint, and I hate to have the choice of leaving a kid at home where I know he's going to fail, or having him out at McLaren, or committed to the OYA where I can keep him for a longer period of time than I can locally. I can't keep him in detention beyond 56 days. So that bed, that closed custody bed that's there, should be for the more serious offender. And, it's not a very easy position to be in when you're trying to make a choice for an individual kid that's in front of you, that you want to try to save them. At the same time, you've got to protect the community. And there are ways to do that by having some other spots. There is a proposal in the OYA budget to talk about some highly secure residential dual diagnosis and substance abuse treatment programs that will deal with 40 to 50 beds, and we need to have that resource. The assessment and evaluation residential centers with a high level of security. And I've talked with George Dunford. We got some help from Dr. Goldberg, Ramona Foley, and Mickey Cerise, Kay Olson, when we were able to get to mine for information the kids that were in closed custody beds that also had a history of abuse and neglect. And there are ways to get to some of these kids without just, leaving them in a closed custody, most expensive situation. Not a whole lot of them, but, these beds are a real start in order to get a way for us to break, give them a real opportunity. And I have to say that when I came down to the opening, the joint session of the legislature, there was a young man that was standing upstairs that's at the Oregon National Guard, and he's a corporal. That appeared in front of me when he was quite a 14-year-old kid that I had to go around with him, his mom. I sent his sister to Rosemont. His mom's finally in school at LBCC. His sister got a high school education and is a productive citizen in Linn County living with her mom. And he's in the military, and he's going to be shipped off to Afghanistan, I think, in the next few months. He stopped by to see me at the office. I don't see enough of that, but I have the resources to try to do that. The guaranteed attendance program that we have at the juvenile department here is like that work release center where it goes from, they check in at 3:30 at night after they get out of school, and they stay till 8:30 in the morning, and it's 24/7 on the weekends, 24 hours a day on the weekends, where they can still have some life but have the supervision that you and I both know, all of us know, that they're not getting at home. When I send a kid to a home where the family's idea of having fun is everybody getting high, it is not a place for this kid to succeed at all. And if I don't want to use the most cost expensive bed that we have in order to try to save that kid. But I know I got one that's fighting for the country now because I took him out of it. I took his sister out of it. And finally, that was enough to get mom to straighten up her life. You need to have some of those in there. And whatever you can do to put a few in, I'd be happy for you to do that. If you have any questions for me, I get a little passionate about this, but I can't help myself.
Any questions? Judge? We very much thank you for your testimony.
Okay.
Thank you for your service and your judgeship, and we especially like that lapel pin you've got.
I'm taking it out. It'll be a fine day.
Yeah. There you go. One thing I think we need to publicly acknowledge and welcome one of our own who hasn't been able to be with us. So, Senator Winters, thank you so very much for being here.
Yeah.
I know I speak for the, it's just a fact. I mean, now that Jackie's here, the average IQ of this committee just doubled, so. Pam Patton, Coalition for Equal Access for Girls. Come on ahead. We can do that. Pam, it is great to see you.
Thank you. Great to see you, too. Vice Chair Westland, members of the committee, my name is Pam Patton, and as you just heard, I'm president of the Coalition of Advocates for Equal Access for Girls. That's an all-volunteer statewide nonprofit organization whose mission it is to ensure that the 1993 Equal Access Law that we passed in Oregon, thanks to the help of Senator Brown, is implemented in this state, and also we want to ensure that our girls that are at risk are getting access to gender-specific services. We also want to give an opportunity for girls and young women to use their voices, and today I think you're going to have an opportunity to hear some of those young women, which is really exciting for all of us. I'm here today in support of the sections of the Oregon Youth Authority budget that will begin to fund the action steps to enhance the necessary gender-responsive services for young women. Girls in this state have been underserved for many, many years. In the last three biennia, with the cuts that have happened, they have had a very serious impact with girls, especially girls in juvenile justice. For the last two biennia, Bob Jester has asked me to chair an OYA Young Women's Committee. Last biennium, I testified to the 2005 Public Safety Committee about implementation and recommendations that the committee made of what we need to be doing to make services better for girls. And we had an implementation committee where we set up a very diverse group of folks to look at what we needed to do in OYA to ensure that girls got the services that they need, the result of which is reflected in this budget, which after a lot of years of coming before you asking for services that weren't in the budget, it's of great encouragement that I can say to you that we're supporting many items that are in the budget now. The three areas, I know you want me to get this through this quick, the three areas that are in the budget that will definitely work to enhance services for young women are in the growth addition of the 145 closed custody beds. That includes the reopening of the Oak Creek facility in Albany, and it will make that facility a single-sex facility just for young women. And part of that is that it's going to allow the Oregon Youth Authority to have a female-only facility that can design and provide evidence-based services that are including a gender-responsive approach. I have worked for the last 12 years at trying to ensure that our girls get access to services that work for them. Services that are generic do not necessarily work for girls. And what we know is that girls and boys are different. And that doesn't mean that one is better or worse than the other. It means that we need to recognize that. And we have information on how those unique developmental, physiological, cultural, and emotional differences that girls have from boys, that we can design our programs that work effectively with them. This will provide us with the opportunity to do that. In order to do that effectively, we're going to need to make some changes to the Oak Creek facility and provide training for the staff and able to do that. You'll find that in the policy option package 104. That actually was policy option package that the Young Women's Implementation Committee designed and wrote. We did a lot of work on looking at what we needed to ensure that girls were going to get what they needed in this facility. And we visited Oak Creek. We came up with a list of changes or concerns that we had about the facility itself and made those recommendations. Those are included in this package. It's not an expensive package, but that facility was not designed for young women, and some changes need to be made. Training needs to occur for the staff in that facility to ensure that, and it also includes the funding for gender-specific mental health specialists for the Corvallis House, which is a young women's transition program. What we want to do is to provide young women with a continuum of services. We don't serve our young women well if we only provide them one part of it, if we lock them up or we give them some parole or probation services in the community. What they need is a continuum so that we can provide them the level of services that they need when they need it. That leads us to the third area, which is the growth addition of the 73 community placement beds, which will be both a residential, not both, but residential, independent living, and short-term placements. This enhancement of the continuum would add a 90-day secure treatment, mental health and addiction stabilization and treatment readiness program. What we know is that one of the barriers that young women have is that they're really not getting access to the services that work for them. If you look on page 16 of the overview that OIA gave you, you'll see the statistics that show you the serious mental health issues that most of the young women that come into OIA have. The fact that that they are 65% of them have co-occurring, which is mental health and alcohol and drug addiction issues. This 90-day secure program would give girls the opportunity to get stabilized. It could be both a pre or a post the facility, where we could stabilize the girls in a secure setting so that they would be ready for treatment in the community if that's what they needed, or if they were, for one reason or another, released early from the facilities, that they could then be placed in this facility to get them ready for a community placement. Right now, if they go back to the community and they're not ready, they run and they don't necessarily get access to the services that they need. Besides, many of the services were cut with the cuts that occurred in the last two bienniums. So what's also included in the community enhancement is the evaluation and assessment shelter placements. And so we're hoping that some of those placements will be for young women so that we can have a continuum of shelter and evaluation of a 90-day secure assessment and stabilization program, the facilities, and the Corvallis House transition program, so that there is actually a flow of a continuum. Because one of the things that we know is that you just can't finish one service and start and not give another and expect that girls are going to go from a locked up setting to the community and it's going to be successful. They need that transitional support. So we have enormous amounts of data. If you want data to show you that these are things that should happen, I can give you anything that you would like. These are evidence-based practice. I think you heard Ed Latessa talk to you. He has an evidence-based practice that works. It's a cognitive behavioral approach. But he has told me, and I don't know if he said this when he testified before, but that what you need is to take an evidence-based practice or theory and you integrate it with a gender-specific approach. So what you do is the theory. How you do it is with the approach. And what we want to do is make this approach effective for girls.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Patton, Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Patton, just a quick question. And I'm looking at the 145 close custody beds and then the growth addition package of the 73 community placement beds. How adequate is the 73 community placement beds?
Well, actually, I think that the growth was 101, and so but the governor put 73 in. Even the 101 is not going to meet the need. And what I guess I should say is, and thank you for asking that question, Senator Winters, is that this is not meeting the need in any shape or form. This is making a statement that we are working towards the direction of creating a continuum that will meet the need. And the 15-bed secure program is just a teeny bit of the need, and it's not going to meet the whole statewide need, even though I think that they could be referred from all over the state. But the idea is once we show that this will work, our hope is that we'll have less girls are going to need the lockup facility is and more girls that can be treated in the community. But it's going to take us time to get there because you're only making a very small dent in it.
I asked that question because if you're saying 73 and the meter is greater than 73, it's kind of helpful if this body knows what the scope of the need is, particularly when you mentioned both pre and post.
Right, right. And why I have to be really clear that these 73 are all over the state, and they're for boys and girls. And girls are 9% of the facility and 13% in the state in OIA. So we're not a big percentage, but the percentage that we need to be serving as well, because all of us know that these are the young women that are going to be our future, and if we're not turning them around now, we'll be seeing them in adult corrections or other needs.
Ms. Patton, we've got one more quick question, then we're going to have to move on.
I know, I'm sorry.
Representative Nix.
Very quick, and you can respond in writing if that's easier. I didn't see statistics on how many of the young women have children themselves.
That's a great question. Do we know that? How many have? We don't have, but we will get that for you.
Thank you very much.
Yes. And actually, that's the next area I want to go in, is how are we going to deal with our mothers and their babies.
Ms. Patton, thank you very much for the great work you do for the citizens of the state. Colleagues, I'm going to exercise the privilege of the chair to call forward one of our ex-members, Commissioner Lisa Nato, and Mr. Snyder, because she has to get back to Portland. So welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Nato, Multnomah County Commissioner and Chair of the Public Safety Committee of the Association of Oregon Counties, and I also sit as Vice Chair on the National Association of Counties Public Safety Committee. I want to first thank the Governor for his commitment to youth, and also to Bob Jester, the Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, for this budget and recognizing the importance of the partnership between the state and the counties in implementing public safety for our communities. We support this budget, and we feel this is a very significant progress towards restoring some of the cuts that have been made to the juvenile crime prevention programs and to the juvenile corrections institutions between 2001 and 2005. It takes us a long way there. This budget recognizes that the state and the county have a partnership with respect to youth. It's a hydraulic relationship, and that if the institutions are not, if they're weak, then the youth who need an institutional setting are forced into the communities, and then we have a difficult time dealing with them. If the community resources are inadequate, then youth who can be properly served in the community will begin to overcrowd the institutions. And so we really are in a partnership with you on this. This budget does recognize that dynamic. And I passed out to you, and I tabbed it because I think we're very proud in Multnomah County. We have a commitment in our juvenile system to evidence-based practices and have been a national model. Coming back from the National Association of Counties conference this week, we were highlighted. We have used evidence-based practices, and I think the outcomes speak for themselves. We have reduced recidivism in juvenile populations with alternatives to detention. And the evidence is very clear that if you take a kid who's at a low risk to reoffend and lock them up with more serious offenders, you actually get a worse outcome than if you did absolutely nothing. And so we are implementing that. Certainly, the other thing we have done is use objective screening criteria to address the issue of overrepresentation of minority youth in our system. And again, we're a national model in that regard. So again, we want to thank you for your consideration of this budget and thank the Governor and Bob Jester very much for the steps we're making forward. I think if we can do this right, we'll have better outcomes with our youth, and then we'll have better outcomes in the adult system as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Nato. Mr. Snyder, did you want to make any comments?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Welcome back, Senator Winters. It's good to see you. And I'm just here to answer questions for the subcommittee, if you have any.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
And thanks for your service. I think these people might be from very far. Are the folks who are representing OJDDA, did they come a distance? If so, would you like to testify now? Or? Okay. Would you like to come testify just so that we make sure that we get you?
Okay. Chair, members of the committee. Am I speaking loud enough for you?
You're great.
Great, thank you. My name is Christina McMahon. I'm the director of the Douglas County Juvenile Department, and today I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association to urge you to approve OYA's proposed budget. The basic and diversion funds we receive through OYA are vital to the important work we do with youth and families at the local level. If the amount authorized in the governor's proposed budget is approved, Douglas County will receive approximately $272,000 a year in those funds. This may seem like a trivial amount in the big scheme of what all of you have to consider. However, county juvenile departments use this funding in creative ways to stretch it to its fullest potential. County juvenile departments throughout the state are using these funds to implement evidence-based services and to keep kids connected to their communities and support networks. This funding is helping us to transform youth who may start out being considered liabilities into productive members of our communities. In Douglas County, just by way of example, and I don't want to make it sound like Douglas County is the only county that's doing great work. I'm amazed at some of the things that go on throughout, especially the southern region. Some of the things that we're doing, we operate a residential treatment program, located in our shelter facility in Roseburg, which serves eight youth. And when Judge Hart, who I started my career appearing in front of, was testifying earlier, I was thinking about what he was describing is exactly right on with what we're doing with our Touchstone program. That program is based on cognitive behavioral interventions and individualized service plans. We don't use a one-size-fits-all approach. We're also operating a youth court, which has recently been found in several studies to be very effective in dealing with first-time offenders. We're offering aggression replacement training, drug and alcohol education courses, girls circle, as Pam spoke to you earlier about. It's very important that you have gender-based services for the kids that need them, that are coming into our systems. We offer Parenting Wisely and a program called Strong Teens, which is a social emotional resilience program. But I really don't want to do the bulk of the talking today. I am very proud to have brought two young ladies from our department who both are from Roseburg, and I'd like to introduce them to you and have you have the opportunity to hear from them the effects of some of the programming that we're doing on the county level have had on their lives. So I think Trinity wants to go first. I'll let you hear from her.
Good afternoon. My name is Trinity Jackson. I am 14 years old, and I live in Roseburg, Oregon. I've been on probation for a while. I got to know the juvenile justice system pretty well. I thought I knew it so well that I could beat the system, I guess. But I got caught up in a lot of different drugs at an early age, which was 9. I was under the influence when I got in trouble with my first offense. I was placed on probation, and even though I knew I would be getting UAs, I thought that I could time when I got them. That didn't happen. So then I knew that I was going to get caught, so I didn't care anymore. I continued to use. The drugs that I used were heroin and methamphetamines. I had been to the juvenile detention center numerous times. I tried to stop using, but I guess I really didn't want to. Then I got placed into the Touchstone program. While in the Touchstone program, I have gotten involved in a lot of different groups. I have been in a courage group, which has made me understand how my thoughts and attitude have a lot to do with my actions. I have been attending ART, aggression replacement training, which has helped me deal with my feelings of anger. I also attend charting a new course, which has helped me see how to use my skills to have a better future. I am in Girls Circle and TND, which Girls Circle is good because I learned how to open up and express myself in a positive way. While in the Touchstone program, I've got involved in youth court. I get the opportunity to be a part of the system instead of trying to beat it. Since being in Touchstone, I have done a lot of volunteer work. I helped raise almost $400 in a bake sale to benefit the county food bank. We also do outings to the animal shelter and help out others in the community. I have seen people that I used to hang out with and use with while on some of these outings, and that has made me realize that I did not ever want to go back to that lifestyle. I've been going to school at Roseburg High School, and I'm starting to transition back home. This is real helpful to me to be able to go to school and have support when I get back to Touchstone from the staff, Mike Miller, Christina McMahon, and my roommate, Amber. I get to talk and visit with my parents, and they give me the best support of all. My parents are involved in the parenting class to help us get through Touchstone. In the future, I hope to be a drug and alcohol counselor. I feel that my experiences will help relate to other kids and mostly girls like me. So I love this program, and I wouldn't do anything to change it right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Congratulations on your success.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Amber Kribe. I'm 17 years old, and I live in Roseburg. I've been on probation for like 2 years now because I got involved with drugs, mostly meth and amphetamine. Everyone tried to help get me help before, but nothing ever worked with me, and I continually returned to my old behaviors. I've been in other treatment programs away from my home, but I never applied anything that I learned when I got out. I just kept returning back. Then I got in trouble again for using drugs, and that's when I was placed in the Touchstone program. And this program has really helped me because I was able to open up to my counselors and be honest, which I've never done before, about my problems. And now I'm dealing with all the things I used to ignore and just try to, yeah. And I've been involved in many activities and groups while in Touchstone to help better myself for the future. We do a thing called Courage Group every morning that helps us deal with our own problems, and we set up individual change plans for when we get out. We also do other groups like Parenting Wisely, Girls Circle, ART, and Strong Teens. Each of these groups teach us different skills for when we get out and when we go back home. The counselors at Touchstone have really made an effort to get me back involved with my community. We do many different community outings when we're in there. Some of them are to work and give back to our community, and other are just for recreational to like see what kind of fun things to do other than using drugs in Roseburg. I've gotten a chance to go to my school to finish up my high school diploma and to set up for my college, which I plan to attend while I'm in Touchstone. And while in Touchstone, I have built better relationships with all my family members. They're able to take me to any appointments that I have to go to, and we get phone calls daily now, and we get visits like several times a week and contact visits, so it's nice. I also have the opportunity for day passes and eventually home visits before returning home full-time. After I leave Touchstone, I plan to be enrolled in college and continue to further my education. I will be more responsible and have better communication skills. I will have better relationships with everyone around me, and I have hope that I will be more happy and have a better future. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Take it one day at a time.
Yeah.
Thanks. Anyone else for the juvenile directors? Yes.
Chair Shields, committee. My name is Tim Lowen. I'm the director of the Yamhill County Juvenile Department. I'm the current president of the Juvenile Department Directors Association here in Oregon. I thank you for the opportunity to come speak today. What I'd like to be able to do is, one, is I acknowledge both Trinity and Amber for coming here today. It's a very brave sort of thing to do, and I think actually we may have some other young people here. That's just a really positive sort of thing. And it represents a lot of youth in our system that are benefiting from some of the services that the state and the counties provide. I want to speak today a little bit about the partnership of our association with Oregon Youth Authority, that county-state partnership. Most of the kids that come into our system come through the county first, and we receive, in terms of referrals per year, about, you have it on a little chart here, that shows approximately 24,000 came through in terms of referrals, criminal referrals, to the juvenile department each year. Beyond that, there's additional referrals for violations and things like that. What happens in the system is oftentimes is that those kids come through the system they may repeat, offend within the county system, and ultimately some of those youth, approximately between 5% and 6%, end up going into the Oregon Youth Authority for placement. We really have this strong partnership, and we want to maintain that. One of the things, the association really is supportive of the governor's recommended budget. We're supportive of the demand forecast you heard Judge Hart talk about, and that which Dave Cook will talk about a little bit more. And we certainly are supportive of the grant funds that come from the state to the counties. What you'll see in the packet that I handed out is several things related to a governor's executive order back in 98 that established the Juvenile Crime Prevention Partnership. That partnership initially established two funding streams, the juvenile crime prevention, high-risk prevention dollars, and the juvenile crime basic services dollars. At the time that that was put into place, it totaled $30 million. In years 2002, when we saw a recession, those dropped to less than $14 million. So those were originally $30 million. What this budget does is to start to restore some of those funds to the system. One of the things I'd like you to consider looking at is the chart on here, which shows the referrals that have come for the approximately the last, I think I have on here, 8 years. And what that does is you'll see a drop in referrals dramatically until 2003, in which time they rose once again. They started to be reduced again, but it's very coincidental that when we lost a lot of services, the crime rate rose. So one of the things that we've tried to do in our system is to be good stewards of the monies we do receive from the state. We try to be accountable for those kinds of funds. One of the things that you will see, it's actually listed on a highlighted page 16, is actually a list of online reports that we put out annually with our partners, the Oregon Youth Authority. Those reports refer to referrals, recidivism, detention, dispositions of youth in the system, as well as community service and restitution. So we're trying to develop ways to communicate the effectiveness of our programs in the system. One of the other things that you'll see on the back of here is kind of a list of the loss, and you're very well aware of this, I'm sure, but the loss of county, of forest-related funds to the counties. This put a huge hardship on many of our counties, and we see potentially a loss of many of the services to the youth that we have in our juvenile justice system. So we strongly support and would recommend to you that you fund all of the proposed governor's recommended budget for the Oregon Youth Authority, but specifically those including those grants that come to counties in support of the services that provide the kind of things that you see these young ladies share about today. Thank you.
Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name is David Cook. I'm with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. I run the Juvenile Services Division. It's an honor to be here this afternoon. Of course, OJDDA urges legislative support of the governor's recommended budget, in particular the demand forecast and the funding streams that my colleagues mentioned earlier. Over 90% of Oregon's delinquent youth are supervised in county juvenile departments, and young women like those who just testified and others in the room can be managed safely in the community with the requisite resources. Most of them are provided by the county, but really critical supports come from state funds in the form of OYA diversion, JCP basic grants, and juvenile crime prevention grants. We urge your support for these, the restorations of cuts that occurred in the 2001 session. Also, over 250 close custody and community placement beds were cut between 2001 and 2005. The governor's budget restores about 145 close custody beds and another 73 community placements. As Senator Winters pointed out in her question, that's not enough, but it gets us much closer to what is enough. These funding stream restorations in conjunction with the close custody beds and community placements really will help restore balance in the juvenile justice system and aid our abilities at the county level to reduce crime and reduce recidivism. Very quickly, Judge Hart, I know, referenced the upcoming release of the April 2007 demand forecast. I think a preview of that suggests that an additional 87 beds would be required to meet the demand in the 07-09 biennium. What our association has discussed as being the most appropriate use is not to add close custody capacity for those beds, rather community placements focused on regionally located, community-based residential treatment for dual diagnosis, substance abusing, and youthful sex offenders, along with assessment and evaluation residential centers where youth can be safely managed and get the care and treatment that they need. Residential treatment programs of this type are all based on best practices aimed at addressing risk factors of delinquent youth and reducing recidivism. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony and your service. All right. I've seen several people come in recently. Are there people that have not signed the list to testify that might want to? Could you please raise your hand? Just one?
Sign for me.
Okay. Ms. Boston, are you not going to testify? Okay. All right, you're welcome. We appreciate your presence on the list. Let's get going with the next panel then. Craig Opperman, Dennis Morrow, and Benson Myers.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, Vice Chair Westland, and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm Craig Opperman. I'm Executive Director of Looking Glass Youth and Family Services in Eugene, Oregon. I'm also currently Vice President for Public Affairs of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, and you have a panel of members here today. The Alliance is an association of 35 nonprofit organizations that provide an array of services to children and families throughout Oregon. We've provided written testimony from the Alliance. I also want to just mention and emphasize that the Alliance has a deep support for the vision and direction of OYA to create a balanced system and series of programs that will hold youth accountable, keep the public safe, and reduce recidivism. I want to take a moment to talk about the Looking Glass Stepping Stone program, which is a community-based residential treatment for boys aged 12 to 18 who demonstrated a persistent pattern of criminal behavior. Youth are referred to this program by OYA and county juvenile departments. There's a program fact sheet in the materials I provided to you. Stepping Stone is a nationally accredited, state-certified, evidence-based practice program. The program received an evidence-based practice score in the highest category. A success rate of 88% for the program's participants is tracked and verified by OYA. We require our staff to have 4-year college degrees, experience, and receive a minimum of 40 hours of training per year. A consistent, high-quality staff is necessary in order to achieve positive outcomes. Yet our ability to continue operation of this program is in jeopardy because of our difficulty in maintaining a qualified workforce. We have an annual turnover rate that exceeds 50%. Having to retrain staff and have new staff due to turnover is extremely expensive. It's also a tremendous strain on the supervisors and managers as well as the participants in the program, the youth. The turnover is due to the fact that our contract rates have lagged far behind our cost of operation. We experience more than a 30% gap in staff compensation when compared to their market value. These are highly skilled employees working extremely difficult jobs that are vital to the health and safety of our community. Our part-time staff start at $8.35 an hour. Our full-time staff start at $9.45 an hour. OIA and the governor have recognized that nonprofit programs must be adequately compensated. The money invested in proven successful youth programs reduces future costs. The youth we serve, especially the children, youth, and families in our community and state, cannot afford for us to do less. Please fully fund OIA's budget request as well as their entire 101-bed community forecast. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Vice Chair and members of the committee. I'm Benson Myers. I'm a senior administrator at Mars and Child and Family Services, and I've worked in our field in Oregon's nonprofit sector for more than 30 years. Morrison is governed by a board of 20 business and child advocacy leaders. And Morrison currently operates three OIA community-based BRS programs, each of which is located in the Portland metro area, all of which serve youth from across Oregon. And they are Rosemont Treatment Center and School, which serves 12 to 17-year-old girls. Breakthrough Day Treatment and Specialized Foster Care Program serves high school-age boys and girls. And Counterpoint Residential Day Treatment Program serves high school age young men, all of whom have been adjudicated for sex offenses. Each of these groups of youth and our BRS programs designed specifically to serve them are distinct. However, Morrison evaluation data discloses some commonalities with respect to the youth's histories prior to admissions. So who are these youth that we're serving? Multiple arrests, including felony offenses, are very common. 90% have had serious school-related problems, such as suspension, expulsion, or failing grades, and are abusing drugs or alcohol at admissions. A vast majority have experienced some form of abuse or neglect. A high percentage have a history of mental health and serious legal problems, including being on probation or parole. And fire setting is a very common trait. Some notable outcomes achieved in our program 6 months to 1 year after graduation include 3 out of every 4 youth served were in authorized community placements, such as living with a family member or in a group home. 85% were in school, graduated, or employed. 65% had had no interaction with the juvenile justice system. And only 4% of the sex offenders served had a new sexual offense allegation. I don't mean to inundate you with statistics. Please understand that Morrison's OIA BRS-funded programs are serving some of Oregon's most delinquent and severely troubled young people who are given an opportunity to participate in reformation services in a community setting. The outcomes I have shared are laudable, but they are being delivered on the backs of our employees, many of whom must live in communal housing, work at a second job, or leave our field after 6 to 9 months because they're not able to financially survive. Evidence of this is nearly a 50% annual turnover rate. A troubling new trend during this biennium is that supervisory personnel are choosing to leave our field. Supervisors are the core group of dedicated, longer-term professional staff who've been willing to tough it out during the past decade, always being told that a livable wage that fairly matches their education and experience will be possible at some point in the future. Through your leadership and decisions that you will make in this session, you have the means to catapult us into the future now. Our programs produce desired, measurable results, and they're a vital part of Oregon's juvenile delinquency prevention and rehabilitation system. But please don't be fooled by our ability to survive in a frugal environment that has existed for many years. Our board members and staff at all levels are at a serious breaking point. By supporting the governor's recommended BRS rate increases and all 101 new juvenile justice community beds, you will be investing in, reviving, and improving our private juvenile justice system that desperately needs shots in both arms right now. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for your service and testimony.
Thank you. I provided written testimony, which is actually eloquent and beautiful to read, so this evening I'd recommend you take that home, but I'd like to highlight some of the key points of it, which I think are the most important. My name is Dennis Morrow. I'm Executive Director at Janus Youth Programs in Portland. Janus is one of the largest adolescent treatment agencies that we have in Oregon. We currently have BRS contracts with the Oregon Youth Authority. We also have BRS contracts with state DHS. We're also unique in that we have a BRS contract with the state of Washington and bring Washington kids into Oregon for the same type of services. I was also part of the original planning team for the BRS design and implementation when this whole thing started. The thing I would like to call to your attention, I don't want to go over the ground that these folks have covered, but I'm here for three reasons today. One is to apologize, actually. One is to recognize, and one is to realize. The apology is to you as legislators. When OIA was originally created, I was one of the loudest community voices against it. I stomped my feet, I yelled, I screamed, I was adamant. I predicted that a standalone juvenile corrections entity in Oregon would follow other states with similar models, leading to a boot camp mentality that treated kids like baby criminals and an institutionally focused system that would serve as a prep school for adult crime. I'm here today to say that I was wrong, or as my kids would say, my bad. Instead, OIA has evolved into a community-oriented organization with visionary leadership that constantly challenges all of us in and outside of the system to look at only not only how to protect the community, but also how to transform the lives of these youth as they enter into adulthood. And there's very few criminal justice systems you will find in the country that you could make that statement about. Secondly, I'm here to help you recognize something I think is very important. OIA's internal commitment to making a difference in the lives of youth is based on evidence-based practice. I know you've heard from Latessa, you've heard from other folks around this, but I want to be clear, when you look at the network of residential programs that are funded by these BRS services, we are not following evidence-based practices. We are leading evidence-based practices. Oregon has had outcomes far in excess of outcomes achieved in the rest of the country with or without evidence-based practice for over a decade. They're getting better as we apply these new practices that are being brought in, but we have always been a leader in the field, not a follower. At Janus, we have two programs that work with OIA youth, one for younger boys before they go to the state training school, one for older youth from 17 to 24 after they come out. We only work with juvenile sex offenders. The older youth program would have been in the training school for 4 to 5 years, in a camp for 6 months, and will be with us for 2 years. Our goal is to have them leave us employed with an apartment, hopefully in a decent relationship, and at least $3,000 to $5,000 in the bank. Our treatment plans is that we create taxpayers instead of tax users. Based on the OIA's own recidivism rates, we had 25 youth who graduated from our two programs. 1 year later, we had one that was rearrested, and that was for a failure to register, not for a sexual offense crime. Our recidivism rate for those programs for 1 year was zero. In the 1990s, we did a 7-year longitudinal study through the adult correctional system of kids who had been through our program for older youth. Of the 94 youth, starting in 1992, that went through that program for 7 years, only two were rearrested for sexual offending. So I want to recognize national experts are telling you how they think we should be doing it, but I want to be clear that we're doing that and more. And when you're funding BRS services and OIA services, that's really what you're leaning into. Finally, I'd like to say let's realize. With all of this being said, let's realize that we are on a sinking ship. The view from the deck looks pretty good. I've just given you that, and so have these gentlemen. But the BRS system has a Titanic-sized hole in the engine room. It's called funding. When BRS was started, I was around for this. We created a model. We said, what's it going to take? We said, how many staff and what are the qualifications? And then we discounted that model 30%. BRS started with a 30% hole in the budget. In effect, this ship set sail after already having hit the iceberg. And we have not only not caught up, we've gotten farther behind. Now, the result, as Benson said, is we're balancing this on the backs of our staff. They're paying $9. We're paying $9.50 an hour. Let me do a little quick translation for you. If I take my staff, which they regularly do right now, and they go to work for OIA in an institution with less qualifications than they are required to have for us, they make $11,000 a year more. $11,000 a year more in a job that requires less from them than we are requiring. And they get PERS and the state benefits on top of that. If they, unfortunately, go to my good friend Dave Cooks here, they can make $17,000 a year more. $17,000 a year more by walking across the street and working for a county government. And both of those job descriptions, which I have available to you, require experience in residential care they can only get working for us. So, yes, we're training people for the state and the county. What does that mean? That means our turnover rate is astronomical. Janus, in the last 6 months, we have hired 36 people. We have hired 36 new people. 11 of them didn't complete their six-month introductory period. One-third of the people we hired took another job for more money before they finished their six-month introductory period. We have had a position open for 7 months in one of our OIA programs, a night position waiting to find somebody to find it. Somebody asked earlier, how does turnover affect kids or affect treatment or affect quality of quick care? I think you would only have to look to our systems and say, if you put a child in 15 foster homes, do you think that they come out stronger? Or I might ask you, how often do you move your child from home to home to make sure that they grow stronger? Do they go through 10 or 15 parents as they grow up? And if not, maybe that's what we need to be learning from. We're routinely placing youth right now at Janus through our job training programs. We are placing youth in private sector employment in jobs where they are making more than the staff that are taking care of them. Almost all of our youth start out coming back making more than the very 24-hour staff that are paid to take care of them. So Oregon, once again, is standing out in a leader, but I want to emphasize we're leading in the wrong direction. Washington State, where we have contracts, the BRS rate in Washington State is 50% higher than Oregon. What does that translate into? $24,000 per year per youth. $24,000. And the Oregon legislature has a letter circulating right now that's been signed by almost every legislator up there, the Washington legislature, to increase their rate by 10%. Because they're facing large-scale program closures with a BRS rate that's 50% above ours, and they're trying to lay 10% on top of it. So I'd like to end up saying, I think Bob Jester has been willing to send a bold message from the Titanic. Plug the hole, or let's find some lifeboats. He's had the courage to say what everyone has known from the beginning. If BRS is to work, and it is working extremely well in Oregon today, if it's continued to work, we have to be able to hire and retain staff to manage and support some of the most high-risk kids in Oregon today. You know and I know we can't build enough jails to hold them, and you know and I know if we put them in jail, that only extends their criminal activity. It doesn't diminish it. So I'm hoping that the question you will ask is not, do these programs need more money? Rather ask, if this were your child, would you buy them a ticket on the Titanic? Or would you want to plug that hole so we can float hundreds or thousands of more kids safely across the ocean over the next 10 years? Thank you.
Tomorrow. Thank you very much for bringing to our attention that evidence-based practice also means that you have competent and qualified staff with the experience and knowledge to do the job. So thank you for that. Representative Cameron.
Real quick question, Mr. Morrow. You said you do contract work for the state of Washington.
Correct.
So your reimbursement rate for those people you're supervising there is 50% more than
yes.
The state of Oregon?
Yes.
And
I can tell you it's the very same kids.
Follow up with me. The people that supervise those, are those people employed here in the state of Oregon, or are they employed in the state of Washington?
No, this is we actually operate programs in Washington State, but they aren't BRS programs. But because of that, we have a contract with the state of Washington, and they have a BRS contract with us to bring Washington kids into Oregon. So we are bringing them across the river into our BRS programs here. So it's the same standards, the same staffing levels, and the same qualifications. But if I took that program and simply moved it across the river, I would have 50% more money to operate it. And in point of fact, I mentioned this in the DHS testimony, one of the ways that we have been able to actually stay solvent at Janus over the last 5 years has been we float the Oregon programs on the back of the Washington kids. Those youth give us enough money to keep going, because the money we're getting is not only not getting us ahead, we're also losing money on that as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Nathanson, and then we're going to have to keep rolling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had presentations over the last few weeks from a number of wonderful organizations from counties all over the state, and I just wanted to say a special hello to Looking Glass, which is from the greater Eugene Springfield area in Lane County, a very well-respected organization for many years. So thank you for being here.
Thank you again for your testimony. All right, we're getting closer on time. I'm going to ask the people, so that everybody has a chance to testify, that if we can try to keep our comments limited to 3 minutes at this point to make sure everybody has a chance. Colleagues, if we go a little bit over, we might end up going about five, and if those of you can wait, that would be much appreciated. Let's move on to Karen Nibler, and let's also bring up Renee Hernandez.
Mr. Chair, for those of us who have been continually late, if we stay over, do we get extra credit to make up for our late minutes?
Yes.
Thank you.
How many hours do you have?
Mr. Chair, you're not supposed to be asking that question.
You could make them take laps or something.
As long as my bills get out of the center. Fire away.
Hi, Chair of Shields and Committee. I'm Karen Nibbler, and I represent the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I work on their social policy issues. I have a letter that I've submitted to you. And the League, if you're aware of us, is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government in order to better build better communities statewide. The League studies certain topics and informs positions, and our position on juvenile justice is that the League believes services for juvenile offenders should be responsive to the needs of the youth and family, utilize diversion programs in the juvenile justice system, emphasize community planning and operated programs, deal with youth offenders in the least restrictive environment, provide treatment-oriented secure custody, and include appropriate evaluation, treatment, and placement for those in the system. The League supports this budget, and we support specifically the restoration of funding for juvenile crime prevention and county diversion grants. The basic services grants to county juvenile departments are necessary to deter youth from further involvement in the juvenile justice system and or commitment to the Oregon Youth Authority. And I agree with the juvenile directors that testified earlier that this budget is very important to the local juvenile departments. And I think we want to spend the money as far up front as we can to keep them from ever getting to Oregon Youth Authority custody. The League also supports the OYA community parole and probation supervision, shelter and foster care options, and outpatient or residential treatment services in the community. According to the data that was submitted, the community placement population was 549 in July of 2006, but the demand for community placements was projected to be 720 in July of 2007. So funding for eliminated residential options should be restored, and I agree with Senator Winters, you know, that I'm concerned about what was in the budget, whether it was enough. And all of these options at the community level are less expensive than putting a youth in the correctional facilities. So, you know, we think that there should be money spent at the placement for placements at the community level to avoid greater expense in the future. The League also supports the phase-in of closed custody beds for youth offenders from the current 850 beds to the 995 beds in youth correctional facilities in 2009. The forecasted demand was 1,120 for July 2007, and I think the result of this has probably been shorter stays for the juveniles who were committed, because the correctional facility also houses juveniles in the adult that are committed from the adult system for longer sentences, so it kind of squeezes them, so they stay for shorter periods of time. We also support the evidence-based programs such as family-based treatment, gender-specific services, alcohol and drug treatment, sex offender treatment, and transition services in youth correctional facilities. The additional staff for medical and mental health treatment are needed for these evidence-based programs, and I believe they have to have a 50% of evidence-based programs in the next biennium. Is that true?
We'll be finding out more about that when Tuesday, right? Next week, and their report on Senate Bill 267.
Okay. Anyway, we are very supportive of Oregon Youth Authority and working with these juveniles, and we want to spend our money at the juvenile level so they don't get to the adult correctional system.
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you very much, Ms. Ebler. Any questions? Great. Ms. Hernandez.
Okay.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, and it's also great seeing you again, Senator Winters. For the record, again, my name is Lonnie Jackson, Director, Office of Minority Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. I'm not here to give testimony today, but rather it's my pleasure, and I'm very proud to introduce three former OYA youth who are here to kind of share some of their experiences in terms of programs and services they've received in the Youth Authority, but more importantly, to really talk about what they're doing in the community as tax-paying citizens, you know, out in our community. And I have Renee Hernandez with me, and I also have Antonio James and Lachey Hardaway, and I would ask the chair if I could also bring them up at this time.
Please, yes. And then, Ms. Hernandez, while they're waiting, if you want to go ahead with your testimony and tell us your story.
Hi, my name is Renee Hernandez. I was in the Hillcrest Youth Correctional Facility for three years. I got there when I was 17, and I didn't get out till I was about 22. I was released from the facility to the transition of Corvallis House, and I did my transitioning there in Corvallis House, and then I got released in September of 2004. I think on behalf of OYA and the transition Corvallis House, I'd like to say some of the good things that I benefit from being in the institution as well as the Corvallis House. When I was in Hillcrest, I was able to complete my high school diploma. When I got there, I was considered a JPC resident, Juvenile Policy Committee. I was at high risk. My crime that I committed was person-to-person crime, is very serious. So I was had very, very strict privileges. I could not leave certain areas without permission. And I was able to complete and successfully complete these programs being a youth. I was able to start some college credits. One of the good things that I was able to do is, I was able to build healthy relations with my family, my sister and my mother. We had treatment groups that we were able to do. So after my time at Hillcrest, I was able to leave. I got to Corvallis House, and I was involved with the minority services. Christina Fuentes, Ron Weaver helped me. They brought me back here to Salem, where I was able to look for a job. I was able to do things with my family, home visits, and so finally I was able to leave because I was able to complete the things that I was needing to do. Currently, I've been clean and sober. I purchased a home last year, and I'm doing great. I work for an optometrist, and I'm a patient care supervisor. So, and at the same time, on my spare time, I'm able to go to do things like this. I was actually in front of you guys last year as well. So this is my second time, and it's an honor to be here. And I also do speeches within the community, Marion County. I also did some things in Forest Grove where I was able to give back, talk to the youth and explain my experience and let them know that that's not the way to go. So giving back to the community is something that I enjoy to do, and I will continue to do that. But that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Ms. Hernandez.
Hi. It's a pleasure to be here in front of all of you and also speak on behalf of OIA. My name is Lachey Hardaway, and I'm a representative of PhD Ministries. And I'm going to read a letter my parole officer wrote, and then share a little bit for the time frame that we have. It says, to whom I'm a concern. Following is a recommendation for Lachey Hardaway, who is currently on inactive parole with Lane County Community Corrections. Due to Lachey's excellent conformance to the conditions of her parole, she was placed with the
minimum level of supervision as possible in June of 2005. Her self-rehabilitation accomplishments have included maintaining steady employment, serving as a peer mentor for youth programs, and participating in Christian ministries. She has received numerous awards for her contributions to society, including the Governor's Award in November 2006. She has overcome many obstacles to achieve her goals and establish herself as a responsible and productive citizen. And she just says, feel free to call her. While point in reading that is that I came from my background before going into youth corrections was pretty bad. I'd never been arrested before, but I had been around all kinds of gang involvement and other things that my mom had moved numerous amount of times to get us away from. And never did I live in, like, right in the, like, a hood or whatever, ghetto, whatever labels that have you. My mom did all she could to make sure that I didn't, and still being around that and having family members that were gang violence and other things like that, I just couldn't escape it. Anyhow, I got arrested, went to different placements before Hillcrest. When I went to Hillcrest, immediately I met with Ron Weaver and a couple other people that helped me to be the successful person that I am today. While my stay there, they had different programs. I also brought some awards to kind of just show how successful they helped me to be today.
You should
tell them. Oh, yeah. I was high honor roll the whole time I was there, college, and I got my high school diploma, completed many trades there, also having certified. I'm certified as to have my own coffee business or to have my own custodial company, any of those things as far as business management. I am certified nutrition specialist. I also did the health occupation program that I think all of us completed. But my stay there, some things that were taking place as far as, like, it seemed like some people would more look forward to us being a robot, and some people would more look forward to us learning to be young men and women in society and coming out to be taxpayers and to be, you know, helping in the community and mentors. And I do a lot of that. The program that I'm in, the ministry that I'm in now, we have so many different ministries. I am the events coordinator for the ministry, and I also work at a beauty salon, and I also do retail at a store that we own. So in that, with working with Lonnie Jackson, Christina Puentes, Ron Weaver, and a couple of other of the OA staff at Hillcrest and at the Corvallis House, there are definitely people that love their jobs and help us to be more honorable citizens and to know that we do have a future, and that we, even if we go into the OIA program, that's not the end. It can always be the beginning instead of our future being the same consistently throughout the years. So that's all I have to say.
Excellent. Thank you very much for coming down to tell your story. It's an important one that we need to hear. Congratulations on your success.
Hi, I'm very honored to be here. My name is Antonio James. I'm here to testify on behalf of OYA as well. Real similar background to Lachey. We spent numerous years together within the system. Came from a background of violence, seen my mother abused, drugs, you name it. Entered OIA when I was 15, person-to-person crime, sentenced under Measure 11, and did 6 years, 10 months mandatory. I started off in Hillcrest, where I met with Ron Weaver. Kind of felt like life was over, and was introduced to a few programs in multicultural services, where I began to open up, I guess come out of my shell, per se. Started to attend high school. Got my GD at 16, went on through high school and got my diploma at 17. Attended several services as far as cosmetology, the health and occupation program she mentioned. I made use of every service that was there, and it was vital to me because I need these skills when I come home. My biggest fear was coming home after doing all this time and not being accepted in society, not being able to maintain a job, have family relationships or peer-to-peer age relationships as well because of the time I had served. The most important things I felt that were vital were probably like the group therapies, most of all, that the staff provided, anger management was a big one for me. Very angry child. I grew up without a father, and it was probably a butt of a lot of my issues. I can't blame him because I'm a responsible adult, but at the time I did. Drug and alcohol therapy as well, because this is what I used to try to escape reality that I went through. And so I was able to get clean and sober. I've been since then. Cognitive work definitely is a big thing, to see how my thought process works, how I got into the type of behavior, whether it be violent offender, sex offender, whatever you have. Really, it all breaks down to the cognitive of how you got to this. These are behaviors you started when you were younger, you learn, and you have to get to the root of that to figure it out. And so I started with that and went to bigger groups like violent offender and empathy and family treatment, where I had the opportunity to have my family come in and apologize to them as well as the victims, and try to make a start or a new beginning for myself before I came home. Continue to work with people, Lonnie Jackson, Christina Puentes, which was a big help, and transitioning. There was no transition programs for me because I was considered DOC in OIA because I was locked up at 15. And so no one, you know, there was no services or anything to follow me home to make sure that I was there. However, these people did, on their own time, not being paid, made sure I got to work. I completed a program called Tools for Success. Before exiting McLaren, I did 2 in Hillcrest and went to 4 at McLaren. In this construction program, had the opportunity to actually have a job lined up before I even touched down home at the Oregon River Blocks project and Portland SkyTram OHSU, a very huge project. I think it's $11.6 billion. And started out before I had a place to stay. I had a job. And so that was a great opportunity that I had, and kind of eliminated a lot of my fears. And without the opportunity to be around some of these people, these programs, I mean, it definitely helped me out. Unfortunately, I got into a car accident a year later and was unable to do the physical manual labor and had to fall back out of the career I had. Because of some of the warts, I have a portfolio thick as hers that I didn't bring today. And I go back to Hillcrest and McLaren every year to try to speak, whether it be in men's forums. I definitely partake in African-American cultural services, and I speak on my behalf, and I take portfolio, and they call me poster child there because of all the awards and programs I've had. Matter of fact, I think this week I have a column in Oregonian on behalf of Town & Country Chrysler. That's where I'm employed at now as a sales consultant. I've been there for 2 years now, salesman of the month, every other month. And so there's a column featured this month in that. And been very successful there with this job. Family relationships, everything. I mean, I wouldn't be able to have it without these people and these services that were there. And I try to make sure I get any chance I can to give back to the youth and go back to let them know that these programs do work. You know, I stand in front of you to let you know I am a living testimony. At no point can I say I have, you know, succeeded or I have arrived, but I have found the direction to go, and I am on the right path and will continue. I'm 24 now. My birthday is March 26th of this month. On that same day, I will be signing closing papers for my first house. And I continue to go the same direction, you know, that these people have showed me to lead. So anytime I can give back to the youth, but most importantly to the people who have helped me, whether it come here and stand before you and let you know, yes, I am a living example of that, and these programs do work.
And I assume you live near Town & Country?
That's where my house is. I live near Gresham now, so it's a 30-minute drive, but now my house is going to be out in Milwaukee, right next to Town & Country.
You need to come back to Northeast Portland if you want to live close. That's the area that I represent. Senator Winters, did you have something
to say? I just wanted to comment and just to say, you know, I think I speak for all of us here. Congratulations to all three of you, and it takes a lot to come to share with us. But you've all done very, very well, and I know the obstacles that you had to overcome. And I just want to say kudos to all three of you, and just keep on keeping on.
Thank you very much.
And I would just like to add the same, and just, you know, it can sometimes be a lot of pressure to be the success story, and just do the right thing for you and for your family. Do it for yourself. Don't do it to impress anybody, and I think you guys will do fine. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Okay. Mary Botkin and Joyce Armstead.
Thank you.
Should have got the other guy.
No, you're reflecting. You may be reflecting off of the TV there.
Oh, okay. Here, let's go inside.
That's a good idea.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we represent the folks who provide the services to all the folks you've been hearing from today. I'm not going to spend any time much to talk about what it takes to make a success out of the kids we represent, or, that our members serve, that we represent. Failures are real simple to identify. We have them in the adult system. What makes successes is good programs, good treatment, housing, and a job. And just for the record, I grew up in Northeast Portland, and I make a pretty good living at the Union, thanks to Joyce. I couldn't afford to move back to my neighborhood, and so I doubt that most of these kids can either, because of the gentrification of Northeast Portland and the skyrocketing prices that have occurred in that neighborhood. You know, all the places that we hung out as kids are now Chi-Chi restaurants that most of us don't want to eat at. So, you know, it's very interesting to watch the change in your neighborhood. We moved into an area of Southeast Portland that was considered worse than Northeast Portland, and we couldn't afford to live there now if we didn't already own a home. So it's very tough, and I understand he's living in Gresham. It's probably the only place that most of folks can afford to live now. Having said that, that's, you know, I'll make a pitch for affordable housing. I don't consider $250,000 affordable, and I sure as hell don't consider $500,000 affordable. But, you know, what do I know? So with that, I really want to introduce Joyce Armstead, who is the president of our Juvenile Parole Officers Local, and let her talk about sort of what it's like to work in the field and what makes her job better and what makes her job tougher. So with that, Joyce, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me be here today. I would first of all like to say that I am a product of Janus Youth Program. I came from there before I came to the state. So I do believe in the community programs and nonprofits that we work with, and probably learned a great deal that makes me a better parole officer today for having been there. Being a parole officer today is not always easy, and I can truly say that we support the budget that's being presented, and would hope that you would support the budget that's being presented today by OYA. The services that the youth talked about who've been up here are services that have been provided in the community as well as in the facility. Those community projects need to continue. We need to be able to have services for kids when they get back to the community. I currently have had the opportunity to work with some girls, and am clearly being seen the way that we don't have enough services for girls in the community. And we're dealing with some pretty violent girls who need some services when they reenter the community. I also have an opportunity to work with some sex offenders, and we're always on a waiting list to get a kid into a program. So the budget would answer some of these questions. It's surely not going to fill the need, but it's definitely going to address some of the services that need to be met for our kids in the community. As a parole officer, you know, we're working with kids from all different areas of the city. I work out of Multnomah County, so in its own, it's a very diverse community to work within. But I wouldn't trade it for anything. I love my job. The kids I have the opportunity to work with and the challenges that come with that give me the opportunity to show to them that they can be better. And I think that the programs that we can offer them that we don't have now cause us to fall short of giving our kids everything they need to be successful. After they've spent 6 months, a year, maybe even 4 years in the institution, they come back to the community and they need services and programs. And sometimes they need those programs prior to ever going to the institution. They need them maybe as a stopgap. Maybe we would stop them if we had a 90-day secure program for drug and alcohol or a 90-day program for mental health services to get them reestablished on medication. I can only say that I really, as a parole officer and with the voice of the parole officers across the state, support that we get more services for our youth in the community because they need it, and we want them to be successful. We would like to parade probably every one of the kids on our caseloads through here to have you talk to them, because I think they all have had different successes. And those that haven't been successful, I think we all question, what if we would have done, what if we would have had. And so with that, I say it's very important that we support this budget. It helps me do my job better.
Great, and very important job it is. Thank you for coming.
I want to add a couple of things that Joyce forgot to mention. We represent the kids the schools don't want to take, and when they come back, the communities the schools won't take back.
Yeah, and that is a real frustration for us, because you have kids who finally have a success in school, in the institution. They finally feel good about being in school, and then we try to get them back into public school, and a lot of public schools don't want our kids, and so it's really frustrating to get them back into that. So I think, you know, we continue to fight the fight and hope that we will represent them well, but sometimes we're really fighting an uphill battle when it comes to getting our kids back into public schools.
And then one more thing, the map that we handed out shows you where the parole officers are located around the state. When I started working for AFSCME some 20 years ago, we had about 20 parole officers statewide. We have ballooned in 20 years to a massive 100. So these folks cover, you know, in some cases, two or three counties. And I will say that a lot of this has been because of Bob Jester's leadership and understanding the need to balance both institutional community and supervision in the community. So he's been a great help, and, you know, it hurts me to my soul to have to say really nice things about him, because, you know, I'd much rather give him a hard time. But he is a good director, and he's done a great job with this agency.
Great. Well,
thank you very much
for coming. Any questions? I think you underlined an important point that there are, what, 3 to 4 times as many offenders in the community as there are behind bars on a given day. And we've got to make sure that they're
well supervised.
We'd
like to keep them in the community. That's
yes.
Right where we want to be.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dole. Senator, can I talk to you before you leave?
You're in trouble.
No. Just gotta talk to you about another issue.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Dole. I represent Crime Victims United of Oregon. I served on the governor's task force on juvenile crime back in 1994 on one committee and two subcommittees. I have been associated with the Oregon Youth Authority since its inception. We were very involved with Crime Victims United with Senate Bill 1, and I have served on the OYA's Executive Advisory Committee since 1997. We are strongly in support of the governor's recommended budget to restore the cuts made in 2003. We believe that it restores accountability to the juvenile justice system and reestablishes the continuum of graduated sanctions envisioned by 1995 Senate Bill 1. Those graduated sanctions and that continuum are outlined in 419C.001 that you have in front of you, that was basically a lens, if you will, into the juvenile justice system and how it is supposed to operate here in the state of Oregon. And that is based and is consistent with Article 1, Section 15 of the Oregon Constitution, which calls for protection of society, public safety, personal responsibility, and accountability by offenders, and reformation. That was actually SJR 32 that was referred by this body back in 1995 to the voters in 96 and passed by over 65% of Oregon's voters. However, I would caution you on this. The governor's budget does not fully fund the demand for services. The most recent forecast shows that there's a continued need for additional services. This budget is 145 beds short of the actual need, and it does not fully restore the pre-recession levels. The OIA had about 1,109 close custody beds in 2003, and this budget would provide for 995. And I might say that, remember, we lost one of the facilities, Prineville. That one is gone. It is now a National Guard armory, and it's never coming back. So at some point, we might have to look at building a facility. And I would encourage that, as opposed to one of the speakers who mentioned a regional residential treatment facilities, because quite frankly, I believe these are open to influence by out-of-state dollars who are buying and paying for our juvenile justice system in the state of Oregon, and pushes juvenile detention alternative programs. And I will tell you that I think these programs in many cases are really damaging our youth and damaging our public safety. And I will tell you that Crime Victims United will have a white paper that is going to be delivered to you on this subject within the next 60 days. Last but not least, you have in front of you two handouts. When Senate Bill 1 was passed in 1995, you'll see in Section 2 of 419C that it calls for programs, policies, and services to be regularly audited by the Secretary of State's office. This has never been fulfilled. The OIA, Bob Jester could tell you, I'm not sure, but I'm guessing they've been audited at least 10 times, maybe more. But the system itself has not been audited. And I would submit to you this. Behind that 419C, when you get a moment, and I know you have a lot to do, but please read the audit. This is an audit that has gone through about 9 years now of refinement, even though it's not been used. It has been now field tested by the Secretary of State for its validity, and it is a valid document, and it has valid questions. But the bottom line still is this: not one county has been audited. We have a bill which I'm going to ask that you please take a look at and please give your support to, and if it passes, fund it. I know it'll go in front of another committee. I'm guessing it's general government, to make sure that these audits get done, because 12 years out, we have zero audits, as I said. And what this does is it lays out a plan for these audits to be done in the next 10 years or five biennia. So that would mean that 22 years out from the passage of Senate Bill 1, we would finally have the job done. Now, when we pass laws in this building, we expect Oregonians to obey those laws. I think we should also expect our public officials to obey those laws. Do you have any questions?
If I could just ask you a quick one.
Sure.
You talked about the 145 beds,
yes,
the additional audit.
Right.
I'm just curious whether you or Crime Victims United would support raising taxes to help accomplish those goals. Have you given that any thought?
Well, you know, I try to actually stay away from tax issues, to tell you the truth. I think we have 20%, from what I understand, more money floating around the building this year than we've had in the last number of years. And I don't get into the tax issues. I think maybe there was a statement I wasn't here for it the other day, but unlike a President Frohmeyer at University of Oregon, I don't consider public safety a cost. I consider it an investment. I do consider it an investment, because it's the number one reason that we have government, is to protect our citizens.
Senator Brown?
Two quick questions. Steve, just to follow up on the 145 beds, I hear what you're saying about the tax piece. Is there something out of the governor's recommended budget that you would cut in order to pay for additional beds?
No, what I'm saying, Senator, is this, is that I think we probably got to go with what we've got, but at some point, we've got to look at putting those beds into place. Maybe we don't do it this biennium. Maybe it's got to be in the next biennium. But I think remember, I know you know this, and maybe others on the committee know this, but Chair Shields, Senator Brown, we capped the system out in 1985 or 86 at 513 beds. And I think if you look at, even if we brought it back to the 1,109 beds that we had in 2003, I think we now have fewer beds per capita than we did in 1985. And I think we all remember what happened between 1985 and 1992 in the juvenile justice system. We had a near 70% spike in violent crime and over a 90% spike in overall juvenile crime, both violent and property. And I don't think we want to go back to that, is I guess what I'm saying. So I think we need to have the beds there. And these beds, you know, as you know, most of the kids in the system, as it's been pointed out, are out in the counties. But what we have in the system, I think there's about 150 of these beds are used for Measure 11, but the vast amount of beds are used for the kids that are put into the system recommended by the judges to be placed in the system, because it's the last stop. It's the end of the line.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just a follow up.
One last, and then we're going to have to close.
On the performance-based audits, I'm reviewing the statute that's in front of us. Are you concerned that the counties are not providing effective services? I'm not sure, given the fact that we're moving towards evidence-based practices, what would be the point of the audits at this point in time?
I think it's this, that if you read the audit, Senator Brown, which I hope you do, it asks basic questions that are not ideological questions. Let me just give you a flavor of some of them. Time elapsed between receipt of referral and the signing of a court order or a formal accountability agreement. Percentage of cases handled formally versus informally. Totals, misdemeanors, felonies, are they property, persons, weapons, or drug? These are basic questions. Was there restitution ordered? Is the child attending school? Was there community service ordered? Was the community service completed? Was the restitution paid for? So it's a snapshot in time to see if and answer the question. We don't really know what's going on in the counties, is the bottom line. It's not about the type of services we're delivering. It's what's happening once they're delivered.
Thank you. And you can discuss that more afterwards if you'd like. Colleagues, we're 10 minutes over. Mr. Bill, we appreciate your
Thank
service.
Thank you. I appreciate
you being here. This meeting is adjourned.